There are a fair number of rivers in our region tagged with the federal wild and scenic designation. We can take that a bit for granted, but it's not like the system has been around forever. In fact, this year marks 50 years since the passage of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. There are some observances of the occasion here and there. Our guest this hour made a durable one. Tim Palmer writes books about rivers and other beautiful places. His latest is called Wild and Scenic Rivers, An American Legacy. Tim Palmer may be the luckiest person alive. He gets to visit the beautiful outdoor places of our country and document them so others can enjoy them as he has. He has now passed 24 books about rivers, the landscape, and adventure travel, and he's won awards for his work through the years. Tim lives in Port Orford, but apparently isn't there very much. Hi, Tim. Good to see you once again.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's great to be here. And I am in Port Orford quite a bit.
Are you?
But
okay.
It's great to be here today. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you were counting. I mean, I was joking about this being the 75th appearance of Tim Palmer on the exchange because you write so many books. You said you thought it was the fourth.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, good to have you back. So for the people who missed your previous three visits, what motivates you? What gets you out there doing this work year after year?
Well, I just love rivers, and I recognize that rivers are essential to life on Earth. These are the lifelines that we depend upon, that all the rest of the creatures in the environment depend upon. They're our water supply. Our bodies are 67% water. So the rivers literally flow in our arteries and our veins. They're important to our economy. The recreational tourism economy depends on these places being natural. And just our community's sustenance and existence depends on them, and depends on them being healthy.
And you have documented many of them, not just with words, but we mentioned with pictures, too. And the photographs are stunning and printed on heavy paper. And actually, a visit from somebody else last week reminded me to ask you this question. Ken DeCamp was here last week talking about wildflowers of the Trinity Alps, and he mentioned he has 16 terabytes worth of pictures. I wonder if your storage is probably beyond that.
I've had to upgrade a couple of times.
No doubt.
Right.
So I imagine by now you've gotten such a sense for the moment of a picture, but still you have to pick a moment in time. It's like, well, this has got to be the picture. I can't stay here all day.
Well, that's right. And I don't doctor my pictures up the way a lot of people do now. It's so easy to do that with Photoshop or whatever. I don't really do that. I want to show places as they really are. Yet I want to show the beauty of nature as it exists, too. So I look for the most beautiful scene I can find early in the day, late in the day. I look for interesting places. You know, every picture has two basic components. One is content of what you're actually looking at, and the other is light. And, of course, the light changes. So I look for great light in a great scene. And when I find both of those, I score.
So shooting in the early morning, shooting in the late evening, and a lot of driving and snoozing between those times?
Well, not much snoozing, okay. but occasionally a lot of driving, yeah, and exploring to find the best spot. And, of course, I have to write for this career, too, and I have to speak. Here I am this morning, and there I'll be tonight at the Ashland Outdoor Store.
That's at 6 o'clock, I see.
Yeah, reception, I think, at 6:30 and a program at 7.
Okay, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So the basis for this book, I mean, I guess it's a little surprising when you think about the fact it's been nearly 150 years since our first national park, but the Wild and Scenic Rivers program, much younger.
That's right. Yeah, 50 years, which is still a good chance, a good track record, you know, to reflect on. And I think it's really important today to recognize that this law enacted in 1968 marked a dramatic change in the way our government and our nation viewed its rivers. Before this, it was pretty much development at whatever cost, in whatever place, and no limit. And with the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, we recognized that certain rivers, the most wonderful, outstanding, intact rivers we have left, are worth protecting. In fact, we need to protect them because they're becoming so rare on Earth today.
Is the act something of a trade-off? I always wonder, especially when I looked at the numbers that you provided, where there were like 7 no votes between both houses of Congress, if there was a bit of horse trading going on here, like, you know, you can have dams on some rivers, but we're going to take these.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the original act, only out of 2.9 million miles of rivers and streams in the country, the original act included 12 rivers and tributaries, you know, amounting to several hundred miles. And since that time, it's grown to be over 300. But still, that's just a drop in the bucket. The goal was to attain balance in our regard for rivers and our development of them. In fact, today, 0.4% of the nation's stream mileage is protected in this program. It's about 3% if you count rivers of 25 miles or longer. So we still have a long way to go if we're going to achieve balance in this trade-off between development and protection.
When you say 0.4, you're not saying the zero. So it is 0.4% of our rivers are protected.
Yeah. Wow, less than 1%. Yeah. Yes.
Let's talk about the basis for the law and some of the people who helped put it together. Because as you point out in the book, John and Frank Craighead grew up along the Potomac. Where did they go from there?
Well, they were educated in Pennsylvania. They moved west. These were two of the pioneering wildlife biologists of our country. They invented the radio collar. They did the original research on grizzly bears in the northern Rockies, seeking out even bears sleeping in their dens in wintertime. They were two amazing guys. They loved running rivers. They realized that's the way to seize much of the western landscape. And they realized that that rivers at that time in the 50s and early 60s were being threatened by dams everywhere. They fought a dam on the Middle Fork of the Flathead River in Montana because they regarded it as the wildest river left in the state, should not be sacrificed to yet another dam, and in the process realized that it would be an endless rear guard battle fighting off development threats unless we had a positive program, an initiative to protect the best rivers while we could.
So something that would offer some sort of blanket amnesty or blanket protection for rivers, so it wasn't a constant case of this river, having to work separately.
That's right. We might think of them as, in a sense, as national parks, but much lower key. And many of them with a lot of private land that remains in private ownership, so they're unlike parks in that respect. But yes, that idea that these are the gems, the gems that we have left, the very best, should be protected.
We'll talk about some of those specific gems when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer. His latest book is Wild and Scenic Rivers, An American Legacy. He will be speaking in Ashland tonight at the Ashland Outdoor Store, brought in by the store and by Rogue River Keeper. We'll come back and talk to him more on the Jefferson Exchange, and you're welcome to join us in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the 50th birthday party for Wild and Scenic Rivers, and it's not really a birthday party in a time and place, but sort of an ongoing celebration of the fact that we have had a Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in the United States for 50 years as of this year. Tim Palmer of Port Orford, who has written many a book about gorgeous rivers with words and pictures to tell the story, has written a new one called Wild and Scenic Rivers, An American Legacy. He's here to talk about it here in the Exchange. You are welcome to join it. Your questions, your comments, your ideas about rivers that should be included or ways that rivers might be better managed. Welcome here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We left off talking about the brothers John and Frank Craighead. And their idea to protect rivers a little more uniformly, rather than just have to keep fighting rear guard actions on each of the ones like the Middle Fork Flathead that they were concerned about. We mentioned, though, that they grew up along the Potomac. Now, they came back to the Potomac years later, and that was part of what motivated them, I understand.
That's right, and they realized that it had changed dramatically. You know, the place that they knew as kids was gone. There were strip mines. There was water pollution. They said, we cannot let this happen to the best rivers that remain, to these rivers that we're now getting to know in the West.
So they did see a window of opportunity. How did they move ahead with their idea?
Well, they talked it up. They were, at the time they were dealing with government officials in the Interior Department, because they were the prominent wildlife biologists in the West. So they bounced the idea up through the bureaucracy. They found some really strong advocates there, some really bright government officials who said, yes, we need to do this. They bounced the idea up to Interior Secretary Udall, who had been an Arizona congressman voting for dams all his career, recognized with me in my interview with him in 1983 that you could not go to Congress from Arizona and be against dams. But yet, when he became Interior Secretary, he recognized that he had to act with a statesman-like sense of responsibility. And in doing that, he had to recognize that our use of water and our treatment of rivers was not balanced, that we had to do something to protect the best that were left.
you know, in addition to the pictures, which again get a lot of the attention, but the text is quite informative about what was going on. You report 70,000 sizable dams by the mid-1960s. So when did sentiment begin? I mean, we talked about the Craigheads, but aside from them, I mean, was there a general sense of when in the national consciousness sentiment might have begun to flip away from dams?
Yeah, sure. And in that era, the 50s and 60s, is pretty much when that happened, because people saw the great losses that were being incurred, and they also realized implicitly that the best sites for dams had already been developed. And as soon as people began to look at the economics of the water developers, they realized that we're now scraping the bottom of the barrel. We built everything that really made economic or hydrologic sense through the 50s and into the 60s. What were left were sites that did not make much sense, that were bound to destroy the very best that were left.
Interesting to see who it takes to make things change at different levels of government, between political people and career people. And Eisenhower, as president, didn't oppose dams, but he did oppose federal ownership. What was the distinction he was drawing?
That's right. Well, the Eisenhower era regarded the public building of dams as, quote, creeping socialism. They thought all of the benefits should go to private corporations, private hydroelectric developers. So that was kind of the difference that they felt, but it was still dam building. And it's important to recognize here, though, that era of big dam building pretty much came to an end in the 70s, because it became an incontrovertible fact that the best sites were gone. There was widespread resistance to new development. The economics were tighter and more strict. So that allowed for what I call a new generation of river conservation to rise in people's minds, which included things like elimination of toxic waste, dealing with agriculture, farm waste, and feedlot waste, dealing with floodplain development, these other issues that were very important for rivers. And it turns out that the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act is also tailored to deal with many of these other broader kind of threats that we now see today, even in our own local rivers, through mining proposals, logging proposals, land development, and other issues that threaten them.
Tim Palmer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is Wild and Scenic Rivers, An American Legacy. He'll be appearing tonight at the Ashland Outdoor Store, running from 6 to 9 as the general window for the event. I want to ask, because we were talking about people inside the government, from Eisenhower, who everybody's heard of, to people, not many people have heard, Ted Shadd. You mentioned an interview with him in 1983, and he gave a hint of a smile. Over what?
Yeah. Well, this was remarkable. He was a budget official. He worked for the Office of the Budget, first justifying dams. Then he worked for Eisenhower, unjustifying dams by the federal government. And then ended up in charge of a Senate committee that was pretty much designed to promote dams. But the Craighead brothers got to him. They held a hearing. He held a hearing for the Senate committee report that was being done in Montana. And out of nowhere, the Craighead brothers appeared testifying that the goal should not be here to build more dams at any cost, but rather to reflect on what needs to be protected. Ted Shadd absolutely got it. He realized the problem in this question of balance. And authored a report that included a recommendation for a program something like what became the Wild and Scenic River System.
So I'm still amazed at the vote, 84-0 in the Senate, 265-7 in the House. But was there a set of rivers that came with the act? I mean, were some protections already? Yeah,
sure. Yeah, I mean, this was the old days of bipartisanship. I mean, and so. So there was widespread support across the aisle for this measure. It actually only designated those 12 rivers and tributaries to begin with, and there were others that were proposed that had developments and dams proposed on them that were actually taken out. A few of those were added later. We dealt with more difficult threats later, But certainly there were compromises along the way, as there always are in a political process.
Were there some key rivers that were lost in the way to getting the bill passed?
Well, yeah. I mean, for example, the Tellico Dam on the Little Tennessee River was included in the original bill. It was taken out. The snail darter. A small fish that was endangered, was known to be there and only there where Tellico Dam was proposed. That river never made it into the program, and Tellico Dam was built. But it was the only dam of that kind that was actually built after that time.
So, Tim, what is the standard? What does a river need to have for inclusion as a wild and scenic river?
Just two things. It has to be free-flowing. That means no dams. And it has to have one or more outstanding values. And these are specified as geology, wildlife, fisheries, scenery, recreation, history, archaeological sites, or even other, which can include interesting and unique hydrology, such as what we have on many of our rivers in our region, like the headwaters of the Smith, the headwaters of the Rogue, Rough and Ready Creek, the Illinois, rivers like that have very unique and interesting hydrology, which can also make a river eligible.
And then what does the status mean? What can and can't be done with a wild and scenic
river? Well, it principally means no dams or federal permits for projects that would damage the river. That can include things like Federal Highway Administration action. But it means much more than that. Where federal land is involved, Forest Service or BLM land in our case, it means a focus on protecting river values when management plans for those lands are done. That's very relevant to our areas even today, because now we see widespread proposals for additional logging in the wake of the big forest fires that could affect our watersheds in a very negative way.
Curry County, where you live. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And Chetco is a national wild and scenic river, so we want to be very careful about how that logging is done. Not that none of it should happen, but we need to recognize that the watershed of that river is very important. It's critical to water supplies, to our fisheries, both commercial and sport. And we can't just go in and wholesale log trees just because they burn. There's much more to think about here.
Tim Palmer is a famous lover of rivers and the author of about 24 books, generally focusing on rivers. His latest is Wild and Scenic Rivers, an American Legacy, celebrating this year's 50th anniversary of the passage of the Wild and Scenic Act. It happened in 1968, and you heard the numbers. It was only 7 people opposed it between House and Senate jointly. You can join the conversation on the exchange, propose some rivers for inclusion, or talk about some of the things you've seen along wild and scenic stretches, because we got a lot of them here, and we'll get to talk about specific rivers in just a moment. 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join us by phone, by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the exchange.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. Yourself?
Great. Hey, I had heard that the Hearst Corporation fought to keep the McLeod River out of that designation. I guess there's three big owners, the Hearst, the Fishers, and it used to be the Balabaca on the McLeod, which obviously lost its salmon run with the Shasta Dam. But I heard during that time they were fighting against the McLeod River being considered a wild and scenic, which it seems like it probably is. But do you have any information on that?
All right, the McLeod River, good question.
Yes, the McLeod, it's an incredible river. What's left of it, as you say, after Shasta Dam flooded the lower reaches of it, it's still incredible. It was made a state-designated wild and scenic river by California, not a national wild and scenic river. The really interesting critical piece here today is that there's now a movement to raise Shasta Dam that would flood the lower end of the McLeod that would violate the state protection of it. The state of California is steadfastly against this proposal, yet the Trump administration, through its Bureau of Reclamation, is moving forward anyway. It's this remarkable case of to accommodate the big water users of Southern California and the big ag industry, the Trump administration is trying to run roughshod over state authority regarding protection of their river.
But the proposal to raise it by 18 feet began under the Obama administration, didn't it?
That's right. It was considered then, but now is when it's moving forward.
So, interesting question, though, that he raises, because you mentioned that the Wild and Scenic River can't have a dam on it, but obviously the Rogue has a dam above the section that is Wild and Scenic. Are there also some stretches of Wild and Scenic rivers that are above dams?
Yeah, there are. Mm-hmm. There are dams above and below designated rivers. That requirement only means in the designated reach.
Mm-hmm. All right. Another set of emails here. John and Eugene wants to know if gold mining, including so-called recreational power pump mining, allowed on wild and scenic rivers. I hope not, he says. John and Eugene.
Yeah, we, you know, the act is calls for protection, and if a river is designated under a wild category, there are three categories, wild, scenic, and recreational, that limits new federal mining permits. But the problem here, the rub, is the mining law of 1872, which pretty much allows miners to do almost anything they want on federal land. So we've got that law versus a whole body of new law, which is intended to protect, at least nominally, our river values. Fortunately, in California, there's now a ban on suction dredge mining on our good rivers. And in Oregon, we have a ban that actually we're still kind of figuring out just how it will be implemented, but a new measure that is intended to protect our very best rivers from suction dredge mining. Also, it remains a threat nonetheless. More so, strip mining for nickel at the headwaters of many of our finest rivers remains a threat because of this antiquated mining law. We've got a temporary withdrawal from new mining permits for that, but we need to get that protection permanent, and there's no sign of that happening anytime soon.
So, because that's an administrative withdrawal versus a congressional withdrawal.
Exactly,
right.
Yes, mm-hmm. Jeffrey.
Right. And so, that's the upper reaches of the Smith and the Chetco, right?
That's right. The Smith, the Chetco, and headwaters of the Rogue through Rough and Ready Creek, which runs into the Illinois, which runs into the Rogue.
Okay, now that we're talking about the Illinois River, we have an email from Barbara Yulian in Grants Pass, who was a big fan and friend of the Illinois and the Rogue. And she writes, since Congress passed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in 1968, the threats facing America's best rivers, many of which are still not in the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System, are increasing and changing. Equally important through science, we now know that it's not enough to protect a narrow river corridor, which essentially is how the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act has been implemented, and that to protect a river, we have to protect its watershed, too. You've traveled most of the nation's wild and scenic rivers. First, how can we increase the public's understanding of how rivers work? And second, on this 50th anniversary of the Act, how can we improve this very popular law so that it truly protects America's finest rivers? That, again, from Barbara Yulian in Grants Pass.
Yeah, well, those are tough, very involved questions, Barbara. Let me take a shot at that. The Wild Rivers Act is specific to certain reaches, but it also requires the federal government to consider proposals upstream that would damage designated rivers. So,
but is it the rivers themselves or the lands around? How much of the lands around it come into play?
Well, if there are federal actions involving land around, such as forest management or mining permits, then that needs to be considered. The law doesn't necessarily ban actions, but they have to consider that. And so that helps in this balancing act between the mining law and subsequent laws, including the Clean Water Act and the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. So we need to engage these new laws when those kind of threats exist. And I think we need to, you're right, Barbara, in that a lot of people are not aware of how dependent we are on entire water systems being healthy and vibrant and functioning. And, you know, I think we just need to keep working on awareness from drinking water to fisheries and on up. Our rivers are essential to everything that we do.
You know, it seems sometimes like you can't leave the Rogue Valley and drive more than a few miles without hitting another wild and scenic river. And in fact, the map in the book kind of put my face on the floor because I didn't realize how heavily clustered the wild and scenic rivers are in our neck of the woods, essentially.
That's right. 70% of the designated rivers are in the four West Coast states. Oregon has the most. California, Washington, and Alaska. That's pretty much a map of political support. In those states, we've had elected political officials who have been receptive to this program, not all the time, but periodically through its history. And so it's given us that record of protection here. So I got to point out, though, that it's still a tiny minority of our streams
0.4%
in this way. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And in fact, you look around the country, too. There are 10 states. You look, Kansas, Iowa, Oklahoma, Nevada, and six more don't have any wild and scenic rivers at all. I mean, do people make use of the rivers? I mean, does a greater percentage of society get out and enjoy them than did, say, 50 years ago when the act was passed?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, our rivers are extremely popular places, and our economies are now far more dependent on resources like this and on the whole quality of life suite of issues. You know, if you just look at the employment figures for Oregon, you know, the timber industry used to be very strong. Now it's just a couple percent of employment in our state, whereas recreation and tourism has risen manyfold in that time. Our communities now are far more dependent on things like the quality of our water, the health of our fisheries, than they are on some of the older consumptive industries like mining and even logging.
Tim Palmer, our guest on The Exchange. His book is Wild and Scenic Rivers, an American Legacy. Scott in Ashland emailed to say, I just returned from 5 days of paddling on the Owyhee River in the far southeastern corner of Oregon. You described the wild and scenic rivers as gems, and gem is truly an apt word to describe the unique, otherworldly beauty of this wild river and its desert canyon. I'm grateful to the people who protected the Owyhee and the other wild and scenic rivers. I hope the generations to come have the same opportunity to experience wilderness as they float these rivers. That from Scott in Ashland. Thanks for that, Scott. Back with Tim Palmer and Wild and Scenic Rivers in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, once again, is Tim Palmer. Always a pleasure to visit with him. He has documented the streams of America in about two dozen books now. Is this number 25?
No, close.
Close, okay.
I've lost track.
Wild and Scenic Rivers, an American Legacy is the latest book, and it looks at wild and scenic rivers, not just in our neck of the woods, where there are many, but all over the country. And the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act itself turns 50 this year, hence the occasion. Tim will be speaking at the Ashland Outdoor Store tonight starting at 6 o'clock. You can join the conversation right here on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760 to talk about rivers you love and want to see protected or are protected. 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. You have your own story with the early Wild and Scenic Rivers Act that you bring up in the book. What was your involvement?
Well, my beginning started as a student. I was studying landscape architecture. And I presented a plan for a bicycle trail system for the community where I was in school in Pennsylvania, actually Penn State. And when I was done, a man walked out of the audience and said, Tim, how would you like to work on a watershed-based conservation plan for a stream being studied for the Wild and Scenic River system? I didn't really know what any of that meant, but it sounded good, and I said, yes, I'm in. And so I spent my senior year working on a plan for protection of a stream called Pine Creek, really river, that grew and evolved, and I ended up working for a county planning commission in northern Pennsylvania for 10 years, and then started writing books about river conservation full-time.
So you're not just a reporter or a recorder. You've actually been involved in some efforts to protect some streams then, too.
That's right. I consider myself, first of all, an activist because I believe we have to take direct action to protect these places that are left. I'm a reporter in that I report on the issues affecting these places in a fair and unbiased way, I feel. And I kind of regard myself as an artist, too, because I love taking photos and showing the incredible beauty of these places.
They can be stunningly beautiful, as always. Let's talk about some specific rivers. The Rogue comes to mind, obviously, and it's in the book quite a bit. How does the Rogue, as you see it now, I mean today, compare with what it was like before the three dams were removed in the last dozen years or so?
Well, that aspect of it is way better. You know, the Middle Rogue had these three old antiquated bucket of bolts dams that really served no current purpose. And fortunately, we got rid of those just a few years back.
Savage Rapids, Gold Hill, and
Gold Ray. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so the next year, we had a salmon run way up here in Ashland. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how's that for success? So we did restore certain that free flowing quality to the whole middle rug. We're still left with the water quality issues and temperature issues, which we need to deal with better. But it opens up this wonderful possibility of the rug of enhancing this continuity that we have from headwaters to sea in a very important way to serve the living ecosystem and the communities along the river.
We were talking about the fact that the wild and scenic sections can't have dams. The wild and scenic section of the road actually starts at Grave Creek, doesn't it, downstream from
Galise? Well, there are two sections. Mm-hmm. Historically, the initial act included the Rogue as really one of the flagship rivers. The Rogue actually was widely recognized as a tremendous recreational and fishery resource in the West, so it helped to pull this system into existence, actually. What was designated then was from the Applegate down to not quite to the mouth, but to Lobster Creek near the mouth. And then in 1988, the Upper Rogue was added from its headwaters near Crater Lake down to Prospect Dam, upstream of Lost Creek Dam.
So two sections of the Rogue then. Okay.
That's right. And it leaves that middle section now. I mean, obviously the Lost Creek Dam section could not be designated. There's a dam there. But that whole middle section now could be, which would be a remarkable advance in expanding the scope of this program to include communities and the economic importance of a river in them.
Mike in Medford may want to go further. He sent an email. He said, as the West Coast seems to be removing more and more dams, how hard would it be to remove the Lost Creek and Applegate dams? From what I've read, the Lost Creek Dam kills a third of the Rogue salmon run. Applegate Lake almost always looks unhealthy. Thank you from Mike in Medford.
You know, the dam removal movement in America has really come into full blossom. There are now 1,500 dams that have been removed in the last decade or so. But virtually all of these are dams that are old, antiquated. They don't serve much in the way of a modern purpose. Many of them are unsafe, real hazards. Unfortunately, Lost Creek and Applegate Dam are new dams. They were built for flood control, and
we are
unlikely to really to succeed in getting rid of those, even if we wanted to. The dam removal movement has a lot of other easier and more obvious targets for removal, other than the more modern dams like those ones.
I was next going to ask about the Elk, which is near your place in Port Orford, but it looks like Ann and Eugene got there ahead of me. Ann, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
Hi, Tim. Hi, this is Jan from Eugene. I'm remembering back in about 1986 when I lived in Port Orford. I met up with Jim Rogers, one of my unsung heroes, or maybe not so unsung, I hope. I was moving to Eugene, in the process of moving to Eugene, and he asked me to talk to Peter DeFazio, who had just recently been elected to Congress, to put the Elk on the Wild and Scenic Rivers bill to attach it. I guess they were doing some sort of congressional process on the Wild Rivers Act. Anyway, so I did go to a meeting over at the university where Peter spoke, and afterwards I went up and talked to him. And he seemed very interested. I'm sure he probably knew about it already, and he's a fisherman, I think. Anyway, to my amazement, he listed it. And talk about Jim and what he did to protect the watershed around the Elk, too.
All right. Thanks for the Jan. Appreciate it.
Yeah. It's certainly Congressman DeFazio has been a terrific champion of river protection, and in a very balanced way. I mean, he recognizes the importance of local economies, and he recognizes the importance of having healthy rivers as a part of that. And he helped to get the Elk and 53 other rivers in Oregon designated. And yes, Congressman DeFazio has been a great champion and also very helpful in dealing with the modern day issue of these massive strip mines proposed by foreign corporations running roughshod over our local areas and over local opinion.
Has
we're very grateful to Peter for all this. Jim Rogers is a local hero to many of us, a good friend of mine. Jim recognized the values of the Elk River. He had a whole career in the timber industry. He was the timber manager for a large mill for many years. Eventually realized that, hey, we're cutting way too much. In the Coast Range, there's like 4 to 1% of the old growth left. Jim recognized we needed to protect what was left, and he recognized his stream, the Elk River, as the finest refuge remaining in the entire Coast Range of Oregon. Jim led that effort to get it designated in the Wild and Scenic System, as well as to get wilderness protection, first for Grassy Knob and then for Copper Salmon area on the Elk. So another a hero of mine also, Jan, thank you.
The protection in the California side for the Smith, the Klamath, the Trinity, the Eel, Jerry Brown was involved in this his first time as governor, and who else?
This was one of the most amazing stories of all that I recount in my book. Governor Brown recognized that state protection for Northern California rivers would be inadequate in the long term because Southern California had more votes and could overturn the effort to prevent dams from shipping more water south. He requested designation by the Secretary of Interior, which he can do. They had 6 months to get 1,000 miles of river designated before Jimmy Carter left office and Ronald Reagan came in. They had to do an environmental impact statement. No one thought it was possible to do it in that amount of time. A team worked round the clock in Sacramento to do that. Meanwhile, a team from the timber industry and the water developers in California worked round the clock. They didn't have to win. They only had to delay the designation. They filed suits in no less than 5 federal courts to delay it. The action to approve the EIS was finally made by the appropriate judge 19 hours before Jimmy Carter left office. Secretary of Interior Cecil Andrus had declined a Reagan request that he turn in his resignation the day before inauguration. He was still secretary when the EIS was approved. He signed the designation 19 hours before Reagan came in, and ultimately James Watt became Secretary of Interior, you know, with adamant opposition to any measures like this. One of the great success stories that we achieved just in the nick of time.
So we've generally been focusing on specific rivers in our neck of the woods. I want to make sure that we get some time in here for other parts of the country, because New Jersey, it turns out, for example, has 3, I think, wild and scenic rivers.
Who would think there are these remarkable coastal streams in the state of New Jersey? And in the Northeast, there's been a whole different approach. We call these the partnership rivers. They involve a lot of private land. In many cases, we think, well, private landowners just kind of veto any proposal like this. But in the Northeast, there's actually a lot of support for protecting local water resources and streams. Citizens band together and actually go to the appropriate government agency saying, we want a wild and scenic river study done here. And that happened in, of all places, New Jersey,
where there's protection for the Great Egg Harbor River. Now, people should understand that there are different values on different rivers. The Great Egg Harbor River doesn't look like the Rogue, but it's got its own niche in the world.
That's right, and actually it's quite wild. I mean, I've canoed sections of that stream and that basin, and you know, you can forget that the whole eastern megalopolis exists when you're back there in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey.
Let's take another phone call. We have Jeff in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Tim Palmer's our guest. His book is Wild and Scenic Rivers, An American Legacy.
Good morning, Tim and Jeffrey. I'm an avid paddler. I paddled quite a few wild and scenic rivers. And even back in the 60s, I worked on trying to successfully keeping a large dam project off of the part of the Tuolumne River in California and the Clavey River, a tributary of the Tuolumne. And those are now in the wild and scenic river system. But what worries me is that with climate change, if there's more severe droughts, more severe flooding, that the tide could turn on the preservation of wild and scenic rivers, and people could get desperate and you know, take those protections away in the future. That really concerns me a lot.
Yes, right, yes.
Well, you know, let's talk about how ironclad this is.
Me too, Jeff. The On the surface, you know, a climate with more severe extremes will give us worse droughts, bigger floods, more demands for water, more demands for power. So you might think that, oh, yes, the big dam building era will come back. But the fact remains that virtually all of the economic feasible sites have already been developed. And the little bit of economic value we would squeeze out of those remaining dam sites, like that one on the Tuolumne that you were engaged in, are really not going to make much difference. And the other big side of this issue that we need to recognize is that with the climate that is inevitably warming and inevitably stressing our communities and our life systems everywhere, the value of cold, free-flowing, pure water is more important than ever. If we want resilient systems that can sustain the kind of changes that we will inevitably see, we need to protect those few free-flowing, cold, wild rivers that we have left, like we have so much here in the Northwest, because they will become threatened when we need those cold, free-flowing waters all the more. One quick example, Yukonam Creek, a tributary to the Klamath, and the other unlogged tributaries to the Klamath and the Rogue River, and virtually all of ours, really, but those are two great examples. We need that cold water more than ever because the main stems of our streams are threatened and degraded by warming temperatures. The Rogue is a great example. More than ever, we need for the tributaries to these streams to be protected because they provide the cold water that is absolutely essential to the fish in those streams and to our entire sport and commercial fishing industries.
So ultimately, is it a happy birthday for the Wild and Scenic River?
It totally is. Yes, yes. It's a great time to celebrate. We've gone from 12 rivers to 300. We have a program that is still well accepted and with some prospects for robust growth in the future.
Tim Palmer is the author of Wild and Scenic Rivers, an American Legacy. He's written many books about rivers. He lives in Port Orford, and he'll be at the Ashland Outdoor Store tonight, welcomed by the store and Rogue River Keeper. That's tonight at 6 o'clock in Ashland. Tim, always great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Jeffrey. What a pleasure to be here with you.